from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the gun industry takes Attorney General Maura Healey to court.
She has a personal viewpoint on the issue of gun control, and we respect her right to have that opinion, but she cannot misuse her office to advance her own personal political agenda.
The assault weapons fight in Massachusetts, all part of our Week in Review. Also today, Emma Donoghue, the best-selling author of Room, on her new novel, The Wonder, and what inspires her.
You can, like William Blake said, you know, see heaven in a grain of sand. If you look really, really closely at a situation, you can find almost endless interest in it.
Plus, comedian and actor Maz Jobrani comes to Boston.
Now, as a Middle Eastern male, I know there's certain things I'm not supposed to say on an airplane in the U.S. Not supposed to be like walking down the aisle and be like, "Hi, Jack!" You know, that's not cool. Even if I'm there with my friend named Jack, I say, "Greetings, Jack. Salutations, Jack."
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll begin today with the gun industry versus Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Massachusetts gun shops and the firearms industry have filed suit in federal court against the Attorney General, calling her crackdown on so-called copycat assault weapons unconstitutional. At issue is Healey's enforcement action last July, which expanded the list of prohibited weapons under the state's assault weapons ban. Here's Larry Keene, vice president and general counsel with the National Shooting and Sports Foundation, which represents the gun industry.
The Attorney General, on her own, without any legal authority, has decided to reinterpret the definition of what constitutes an assault weapon in Massachusetts. It was not done by the legislature, and her definition has no basis in the statute and is inconsistent with the legislative history and intent.
Keene calls the Attorney General's enforcement directive on assault weapons vague, ambiguous, and unconstitutional.
She is hurting small mom-and-pop businesses in the state of Massachusetts that comply with the law. She has a personal viewpoint on the issue of gun control, and we respect her right to have that opinion, but she cannot misuse her office to advance her own personal political agenda.
Now, we heard from the Attorney General on this issue this week on Radio Boston. She told us her enforcement action is consistent with Massachusetts law and is aimed at stopping sales of weapons that have been slightly modified in an obvious effort to get around the state ban on assault rifles.
The sale of that kind of weapon is actually banned under Massachusetts state law, but yet 10,000 of those very weapons were sold in this state last year alone. They made copycat versions of these assault weapons. They even went so far as to market on their website that these weapons were, quote, Massachusetts compliant.
So let's jump right into our Friday Week in Review, beginning with the legal debate over assault weapons in the state. And this week, our Week in Review panelists include Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And John Carroll, Professor of Communication at Boston University and WBUR Senior Media Analyst. John, always good to have you as well.
Always good to be here.
So I'll start with you, John. Obviously, this argument is going to come down to what the legislative intent was and what the statute actually says about assault weapons and copycat assault weapons. But do you have any sense of, in this early going about who's right here?
Well, I got my legal degree from the Jerry Orbach School of Law, so I don't think I'm really an expert on the legal aspects of it.
Well, you're one degree ahead of me.
There you go. But I think that this is going to be an interesting tug of war, because what we see at the federal level with Barack Obama doing executive orders left and right because the legislature isn't willing to move on something, we're seeing here as well. I'm assuming that Maura Healey went this route because she didn't think that the legislature was going to take a bite of this apple. So I think that that just having this on the radar screen is a good thing, whether she wins or loses, because I think that there's a lot of talk about violence going on, but there's very little action. At least this puts the issue on the front page. And then one last thing. It's always interesting when major industries pull out the mom and pop stores to make their case. I'm not sure this is about mom and pop stores as much as the firearms industry in general.
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, it was the slaughter at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando that prompted Healey to issue this directive. She said that the sale of the kind of weapon that is banned under Massachusetts law. It was the weapon that was used in Orlando was banned under Massachusetts law, but literally thousands of virtually identical versions of this gun are sold every year here in the state. So that's what she was concerned about. Jim, what do you hear in this debate?
Well, I didn't even get my degree. I flunked out. So, look, the Massachusetts legislature historically has been very active on this issue. We have some of the tightest gun laws in the country, and the state seems quite happy with those. And what I'd say is this is one of those things that, frankly, the courts are going to have to sort out. It gets into an interpretation of one-off weapons and whether they fit the definition of what has already been banned by the legislature.
Yeah. Well, there's something that both sides agree on in this debate, and it's the effect of Healey's enforcement action. Here she is talking to us earlier this week about that.
The good news is that we're about 2 months out from that enforcement notice, and sales of those weapons have essentially stopped here in the state.
So the gun industry actually agrees with that. When I was talking to Larry Keene today, he said she's right about that, and that's a problem as far as they're concerned. But, Jim, let me come back to you. John talked about no action in the legislature. Of course, the Massachusetts assault weapons ban was passed back in 1998. Is the legislature going to eventually have to sort of step in and resolve this, or is this going to be left up to the courts? What do you think?
I think it's going to be left up to the courts in the short term, and it may want the legislature might want to step in afterwards and address it once again. But I think the courts will decide this one.
Yeah. Well,
the other way that people could go is through a ballot initiative, and I think that if this does fail in the court, it may be a route that that the gun control people would take. Ballot questions are becoming more and more the vehicle for public movements, for more community-based movements.
It's an interesting debate. I mean, when you talk to the folks at the gun industry, they say, look, the assault weapons have been defined a certain way for the last 20 years, and their claim is that Maura Healey has sort of expanded the definition without authority. But if you look carefully at the definition of what an assault weapons ban is in the state statute, which I did today, it sort of got me thinking that because it's been interpreted a certain way for the last 20 years doesn't necessarily mean that that's the correct way. I mean, I'm not weighing in because, like, I don't have one of these degrees either, and I'm happy to leave this
up to the court. Set a pretty high standard here, haven't I?
But I do get the sense that this is a really interesting debate, and it'll be interesting to watch how the courts weigh in on it.
Well, it's clear that the gun industry is trying to make an end run of the law, and I think that their interest in that is obvious, but also the public interest in not letting them do that is also obvious. And I think that you have the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And I think they're certainly, if they're within the letter of the law, they're certainly violating the spirit of the law and taking advantage.
Yeah, I think one part of this argument, it sort of comes down to if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. And I think what Maura Healey is saying is no matter what if you sort of make these minor adjustments to these guns, they still have a lethality that knows no bounds, and they need to be stopped.
Yeah, you know, it's also an important test for a new court and how they will interpret this. Will they interpret it in terms of going back to the original intent of the authors, the co-sponsors of the legislation, or whether they'll actually take a look at it in terms of its function, its impact on people?
All right. Well, let's move on to another big story this week. The Supreme Judicial Court overturned a firearm conviction of a young black man arrested after fleeing from police. The court ruled that the officers essentially used racial profiling and didn't have the right to stop the defendant based on the vague description they were given, and they couldn't use the fact that the defendant ran from police against him. And its ruling, the court cited a 2014 ACLU report that found blacks were stopped at a disproportionately high rate in Boston compared to whites. The ruling says black men may run from police, quote, to avoid the recurring indignity of being racially profiled. This was a big decision here in Massachusetts, John. What do you make of this ruling?
I think this one is opening up a family-sized can of worms, because what you have is an action that normally would trigger a police chase, And what this ruling is saying is you can't chase these people. And I think that that opens up these possibilities for real misinterpretation of what people are doing. Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans didn't like this ruling at all and said essentially they misread a Boston Police Department study and an ACLU study. But I think that on a common sense level, this makes perfect sense. However, on a day-to-day level and on a practical level, I'm not sure that this is going to actually alleviate the situation. I think this may actually exacerbate it.
Interesting. Well, let's listen to Boston Police Commissioner Bill Evans, who was critical of that ACLU report that the court cited. Here's what he said.
I think relying on a report that is clearly biased by the ACLU, it really bothers me. And, you know, our officers do a great job out there every day taking the guns off the street, and they're going to continue to do that.
Jim, what did you see in this decision?
Well, I would agree with John on that in terms of, you know, even if you think about what's happened in recent days in Charlotte and in Tulsa, you talk to folks who are police officers, and then you talk to folks who are not police officers, who are the policed, and it's almost like watching a Rorschach test. So What comes out of this in terms of what it tells the public as to how to behave and how police should behave in situations, it makes it very, very cloudy and hard to, again, functionally think about how the police should do their jobs.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, the ruling came out in a week of two more fatal police shootings of black men, one in Tulsa, another in Charlotte. We spoke to retired federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, who talked a little bit about the impact that this ruling might have going forward. Here's what she said.
It will force the courts to put in context what we've all been watching on the news and what we've all been reading about, to put in context the profound feeling of illegitimacy that we have heard about between the police and African-American males. And maybe it'll force the officers to pause before they begin one of these encounters.
What do you think? Do you agree with that, John?
I hate to disagree with someone who has a real legal degree, but I think that the lines on the street during incidents like these are so blurry anyway. And I think that this blurs them even more, and it adds a level of uncertainty. I'm not saying that the court isn't right. I'm not saying that the court isn't wrong. I really don't know where to land on that. But I think that you take a chaotic, uncertain situation and you make it more uncertain. And I think that can only lead to really ambiguous actions on the part of the police. I think it puts them in a really difficult position, but I think the police in many ways have put the public in a really difficult position. So it's a coin flip as far as I can tell.
Mm. Final thought from you, Jim.
I agree with the thrust of what Judge Gertner said in terms of what needs to happen within the police in terms of more training so they actually pause before they take certain actions. What I think is difficult about it is we need to work on the police training and strategies and who they're recruiting. But I don't think we want to actually make it much more hard for them to interpret what a suspect may be doing. We want to make that easier, in fact.
All right. Well, let's move on. Gentlemen, time is we are up against the clock here, and I want to leave time for our hubbubs, those stories that caught your attention but maybe fell below the fold of the newspapers this week. Jim, what's your hubbub?
Well, fall is in the air, and so is music with the opening of the BSO, but today also marks the return of the street pianos.
They seem to be everywhere.
They are everywhere, and the Globe is reporting there are 60 of them in every nook and cranny of Boston, from Athens Bakery in Brighton to Kendall Square in the north, Dudley Cafe in the south, and out to Sullivan's at Castle Island. They're around for about 3 weeks, so if you want to, put in earbuds.
Now's the time.
Okay. That's so mean.
Okay, John.
I try them sometimes. I'm lousy.
My hubbub is that there are three illuminated manuscript exhibitions here on display right now in Boston. It's a collaboration of Harvard University's Houghton Library, Boston College's McMullen Museum of Art, and the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. This is the largest exhibition ever presented in North America. America of medieval and Renaissance manuscripts and early printed books. It's running in all of them, at least through the beginning of December. The one I'm really interested in is the first Florentine edition of Dante's Divine Comedy with illustrations by Botticelli. Cool. Look for everybody there.
All right, that sounds great.
I'll go with you.
Well, here's my hubbub. It's about the Patriots. I want to just tip my hat to Jacoby Brissett, the third string quarterback for the New England Patriots, who started last night because Tom Brady, of course, is suspended. Backup quarterback Jimmy Garoppolo was injured. Brissett led the Pats to a 27-0 shutout of the favored Houston Texans. We all know about this, but here's the detail about Brissett that hasn't been widely reported. Last night, he became the first black quarterback to start a game for the New England Patriots in their 56-year history. In fact, he's just the sixth black quarterback to play for the Patriots at all. So another color line gets crossed, another reminder of how long this kind of progress can take. But tip of the hat to Jacoby Brissett, a great game last night. And that's it. Jim Sturgis, Executive Director of the Pioneer Institute, thank you so much for coming in. Have a great weekend. And John Carroll, Professor of Communication at BU and WBUR Senior Media Analyst. Have a great weekend, gentlemen.
You too.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Novelist Emma Donoghue is perhaps best known for her best-selling novel, Room, about a 5-year-old boy named Jack who spent his life imprisoned in a tiny shed with his mother, who was abducted by a man 7 years earlier. A film based on the book came out last year, and Donoghue was nominated for an Academy Award for her screenplay. Now, Emma Donoghue has a new novel, The Wonder. It tells a different kind of story, though it, too, is about a child who was confined and isolated with an adult who watches over her. The Wonder is set in 1850s Ireland. 11-year-old Anna O'Donnell has lived without food for 4 months, and the locals have begun to wonder if her survival is some kind of a miracle, if she's some kind of a saint. They enlist Lib Wright, an English nurse, to sit with the child and watch her, to see if she's really surviving without sustenance or instead perpetrating some kind of hoax by sneaking food. Emma Donoghue will be talking about The Wonder tonight at the Harvard Bookstore, and she's with us now. And welcome. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So this novel, I understand, was inspired in part by a true story, that of Sarah Jacob of Wales in the 1860s and other similar stories. Can you tell us a little bit about the sort of true stories that provided the seed for your idea?
Sure. Here. I've been fascinated by the fasting girls, or they were sometimes known as miraculous maidens. I've been fascinated by them for about 20 years. But some of the cases just struck me as too heartbreakingly sad. For instance, Sarah Jacob, you mentioned, there was a very formal watch put on her and she died rapidly. So what fascinated me in particular was the idea that by being brought in to look at the situation, the media and the hired nurses would actually make it worse. They clearly in some way destabilized whatever was going on, and Sarah headed towards death. So I could never write such a sad story, but eventually I decided that my interest in this kind of case was not going away, so I thought I would make up a fictional version. And that allowed me to set it in my own homeland of Ireland, because Ireland is the Irish define themselves as the people who survived famine. You know, we take pride in that heritage of poverty and desperation and being hard done by. So I thought putting this story of voluntary hunger in the long shadow of the famine, where so many had died involuntarily, it would give it a rich context.
Really interesting. So how do the real stories, like the stories of Sarah Jacobs and the story of Anna O'Donnell, your character in The Wonders, how do they diverge?
Well, I borrowed a lot of details from different fasting girls, all the way from, there are some in the 16th century, there are some in the 20th. Some of them were, you know, overtly religious, but some didn't mention religion when they encountered the press. They just said, oh, I don't need food, or I can live on air, I can live on light. There was a very famous one called Molly Fancher in Brooklyn. Some of them were ill or catatonic, and some of them appeared to be radiantly healthy. And many of them, we don't even know their names. All we know is that somebody wrote the papers about them, and all these different authoritative men speculated on whether they were total shams or magically gifted or miraculous saints. So there are fascinating kind of blank pages on which all these different cultural fantasies were projected.
Interesting. I mean, was there, do we believe that it's related to what we know as anorexia today?
Definitely. I'd say it's part of the cultural history of anorexia. Yeah, it took different forms. Yeah. They never boasted of their thinness, but they did, in a way, boast of their refinement and purity and femininity, you know, that they were the ultimate girls. They were rising above the needs of the body. They were, you know, pure looking and ultimately feminine. So I think it's no accident that most of them were adolescent girls.
Interesting. So I want to ask you a little bit about the protagonist in The Wonder, Lib Wright. She's an English nurse. She served under Florence Nightingale in the Crimea. And she doesn't have a whole lot of tolerance for the Irish community's religious zeal, their superstition. So tell me a little bit about her.
Sure. Well, I knew... you know, to reveal any weirdly inward-looking, homogenous little group, it's very helpful to have a stranger come to town.
Right.
And I thought in this case, if they were hiring a good nurse, there really were not many around. And the Nightingale-trained nurses from the Crimean were an entirely new breed of kind of rigorously scientific and well-trained nurses. Other than that, being a nurse was just like a scullery maid, very lowbrow job. So I thought it was very credible that this character would be English. And if so, I knew that the qualities which would make her rather like 21st century readers, you know, fairly skeptical and rational, they would be offset by a lot of anti-Irish baggage, because the English of this period really believed the Irish were the losers of Europe who had brought the famine on themselves through sheer laziness.
Mm.
So, you know, I didn't want her to be always correct. I wanted her own prejudices, her own fixed ideas to get in the way of her understanding this very strange situation.
So she's sent to watch, but when the child's health seems to decline, she sort of ends up in a bit of a moral dilemma here, because she's worried, right, that is she responsible for the child really starving herself because she's being watched and she therefore maybe can't sneak the food that she was suspected of sneaking? I mean, it puts Liz in an interesting situation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And you might think, oh, surely her job is to heal. But, you know, nurses in those days, they were strictly under the thumb of doctors. And Lib Wright is working under the thumb of a particularly stupid Irish elderly doctor who embraces all these different theories, like maybe you can live off light or magnetism or smell or tobacco.
Interesting. Is this a little bit about a story of science versus faith as well?
It certainly is.
Yeah.
But science is shown to have its limits too. You know, there's one visit from a very rigorous scientific doctor and he's entirely unsympathetic and he just wants the girl force-fed immediately. So these ethical dilemmas come up all the time, even nowadays. If you think of scientists running a study, occasionally they have to call it off halfway when they realize that whatever medicine they're trying out is having harmful effects or no effects. And they agonize over, you know, what if the placebo group aren't getting any good effects and the others are getting all the good effects. And similarly, you know, we have a lot of agonizing over end-of-life issues and the legislation around this. And for instance, in the treatment of people with eating disorders, you know, do we have the right to force feed? Do we have the right to make people subject to medical treatment that they're refusing? And where are the limits of parents' power over children as well? Do you have the right to not vaccinate your kids?
Yeah. This is a really interesting book. And I want to ask you a question that sort of relates it to another book that you're known very well for, and that is Room, which we mentioned in the introduction. And both these books, it seems to me, you know, they share this idea of a child in an enclosed space with an adult watching them. And a lot of the action unfolds sort of around that scene. And I read something that you said about keeping characters in a single room or space, that it limits their movement and freedom and intensifies the heat on the of the narrative. I'd love you to say more about that.
Yeah,
because
I suppose
there's a lot that happens even though a lot isn't happening.
I suppose it creates a sort of a hothouse atmosphere. And I'm also, you know, I see myself very much in the line of Jane Austen, who boasted of writing on a little square of ivory. She said that compared with her male peers, you know, she was not covering big sweeping plots. She had just a few families in a country village. I really like those intense effects when you get up close. And I also think of it as to do with the unities of time, space and action that, say, 17th century playwrights always followed. You know, if you basically limit your action to two nights, a couple of characters and one single place, there's a wonderful intensity. I would say in some ways The Wonder is like Room turned inside out, because nobody is locking this child up. It is entirely her mind that's doing it. Just as Jack in Room was physically locked in, but his mind was expansive and roaming. So I set myself very different problems posed with this one, and it's much more about the psychological traps that you can impose on yourself.
Both, of course, about children. You write often about children. What is it about them that makes them such interesting subjects for novels?
You know, it's funny. I don't see them as a special subject at all. They're a huge percentage of the human race. We all start as children.
This is a good point.
Yeah, I think it's extremely odd that some writers limit themselves to adults. Yeah. You know, it's like when people ask me, oh, why do you write in other centuries? How strange. And I think, why would you stay in your own?
I want to ask you finally just about the film of The Room, because I had a sense almost in seeing the film that there was a sort of lighter and more hopeful feeling in the film, especially when you see Jack emerge from the room and being sort of overcome by the wonder of the outside world. Was it lighter than the book?
By the end it is, but it's also been more devastating to begin with because everything in film is more upsetting. You know, when you add the music in particular, grown men start to sob. So I think film is really visceral. You know, when you see the vulnerability of that little boy, there are many shots of his little feet landing on various surfaces. So the film makes you fear more and feel more. And so, yes, it does reward you more in the end as well.
All right. Well, Emma Donoghue is a novelist and screenwriter, perhaps best known for writing the novel and the film Room. She'll be talking tonight about her new novel, The Wonder, at the Harvard Bookstore. You can get more information at radioboston.org. And Emma Donoghue, such a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be right back. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Talking about race in America these days can be a touchy issue and not necessarily great grist for comedy. But the Iranian-American actor and comedian Maz Jobrani has figured out how to talk about this stuff and make people laugh. So here's an example. Here he is talking about his mother's support for Donald Trump.
She goes, Maz, I like this guy because he says what's on his mind. I go, Mom, are you crazy? He's anti-immigrant, okay? I go, if he became president, your relatives couldn't come to visit you. She goes, I don't like them anyway. He saved what's on his mind, so I don't have to say what's on my mind.
You may know Maz Jobrani from his comedy specials, and he's also a frequent panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. In fact, he's going to be on this weekend. He's also the author of I'm Not a Terrorist, But I've Played One on TV, and he's going to be performing at the Wilbur Theater tonight, and he joins us right now in the studio. And Maz Jobrani, what a great pleasure to have you come in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. Sure. Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
So we played that take on Trump and your mother. I love that bit. Is she still a Trump supporter?
You know, it was funny, actually. I was trying to stay away from Trump material because there was so much Trump stuff going on. And every day, it's hard to keep up with the guy. I mean, he just says more and more ridiculous things every day. And it wasn't until I went to visit my mom when she brought him up. The conversation went a little differently than the way I ended up telling it as the joke. But the conversation went, she was saying, oh, he's very interesting, very entertaining. She goes, I like him. And I go, wait. Are you going to vote for him? She goes, no, I wouldn't vote. I just think I like the guy because he's entertaining. And I was like, Mom, let me sit you down for a second. And I kind of broke it down for her. But then that led me into this joke. And what was interesting was then I realized that a lot of people do like him for reasons that are kind of trivial. One is it's entertaining. In all honesty, like I go to bed every night going, I wonder what he's going to say tomorrow.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been entertained every day.
Yeah.
And he just says crazier and crazier stuff every day. And then the other thing is that I ran into was I realized a lot of immigrants like him. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but I was in an Uber with an older Armenian guy. And this guy loved Trump. What happens is a lot of immigrants come into this country and then they don't want any more of them coming.
No. Did you ask this Uber driver about that?
No, well, he started talking. Somehow it turned to politics.
Yeah.
And then he barely spoke English, but he loved Trump. So he kept trying to tell me what a great politician he is.
Yeah.
But he kept saying what a great politic he is. So the whole drive is Donald Trump, very good politic. Number one politic, very good politic. Number one. And the whole time I'm going like, oh my God, this guy's an immigrant. And I wanted to say, listen, dude, you're an immigrant. He's anti-immigrant. And he would have said, yes, but I'm here. So he's very good politic, you know? And now you were just talking about this thing of like, it's just breaking news that Ted Cruz is endorsing Donald Trump. It came up on my phone, and I was like,
"So this is just broken." I wasn't going to ask you about it, but why not riff on the news? I mean, what strikes you about that?
Well, I'm serious. It came up as on my phone. It said breaking news: Ted Cruz endorses Donald Trump, and I looked at it. I was like, "Oh, great! One horrible human being just endorsed another horrible human being." I mean, I don't know if that's something to brag about, right? And it's just it's crazy. Like I don't get how I don't understand how we're even close. And I'm sure sometimes you watch and you go, "How is this even happening?" And part of me thinks that Trump is trying to lose because it feels like he just says crazier and crazier. When he came out and said that Obama was the founder of ISIS, and then they asked him, "Wait, do you mean he's the founder or his policies influence?" And he goes, "No, he's the founder of ISIS." And then the next day he came out and said, "I'm just kidding. You don't get sarcasm? I'm kidding." And I'm thinking to myself, you're not at a barbecue. You can't just say, "I'm just kidding."
You're running for president.
You're running for president, man.
I have a question for you. One of the things, I was watching a whole lot of your clips today, and what you do really, really well is you take a lot of issues that are really freighted with sort of heaviness in our culture, and you make people laugh about them. I mean, even that clip about your mother, and you know, you can wade into sort of attitudes about immigrants and attitudes that immigrants have, and somehow you are light and okay with it. How do you do that? How do you think about that? And is there some material where do you find yourself going into areas where you just say, I can't go that far?
I think the main thing is if you're going to make fun of any kind of heavy situation, that you make fun of, never make fun of the victims. That would be, that to me isn't funny. And try to make fun of those in power. So, for example, depending on what's happened, for example, you know, I was born in Iran, grew up in America, so I'm watching a lot of the Islamophobia, a lot of the anti-Middle Eastern sentiment that's out there. So when I make fun of that, I make fun of how people misinterpret and mistreat Middle Easterners.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you heard about this. There was a guy on a Southwest flight going from L.A. to San Francisco talking on the phone with his dad in Arabic, and the passengers overheard, and they kicked him off the plane. So I talk about that on stage, and then I come back and I say, "Listen, if you're Arab in this audience, here's my advice: don't speak Arabic on an airplane, because the passengers will kick you off." And I say, if you are going to speak Arabic, at least throw in some friendly words in the middle to put people at ease. So as you're speaking your Arabic, just, you know, al mahala mahala mahala, which is not Arabic, but al mahala mahala, just be like, you know, strawberry, you know, just put people at ease in the middle of it.
I want to play another clip. This is about, this is from the Laugh Factory back in July, and it's about you watching Fox News and what you make of it. It's about 20 seconds long here.
You start watching enough Fox News, you think the world is out to get you. You think the Mexicans are here to take our jobs and the Muslims are going to kill us. I'm going to get eaten by a shark. I might get eaten by a Mexican Muslim shark. Who's got the Zika virus.
That's a good lie. Did it really have that effect on you? Do you really start sort of looking around and looking at your fellow Middle Easterners and going, well, what's that guy about?
Anthony, I watched, there's this lady, Judge Jeanine Pirro. I try to just flip on Fox just to see what they're saying.
Yeah.
She was on there and she was screaming so much about the end of days and Armageddon and how the immigrants are coming to get us. I honestly started doubting my own situation. I was like, maybe she's right. and I had to go over and hug my Indian wife to feel at ease again. I was like, okay, you're on my side. You're not trying to get me, are you? And she said, no, it's all good.
It's all good. So let me ask you about what you're involved with now. You're the author of I'm Not a Terrorist, but I've Played One on TV. In fact, that's really true. You did play one on TV,
yeah, so
right?
Early in my career, when you're an actor of Middle Eastern descent, I always say the types of parts they give you. They go, oh, you're Middle Eastern. Great. Can you say, I will kill you in the name of Allah? And then you always respond with, I could, but what if I play the doctor? And then they go, great, then you can hijack the hospital.
Oh, my God.
So I went through some of that early on, yeah. and I did a Chuck Norris movie of the week. And in the book, I talk about those experiences. I talk about growing up Iranian in America. I talk about my travels around the world. And yeah, the book came out. It's an LA Times bestseller now. And then I also have a stand-up comedy special of the same name that's on Netflix now.
Was it hard? I mean, if you look back on that and said, I mean, look, I understand when you're starting out, you're struggling, you take the jobs that you can get. But is there any part of you that thinks, you know, I shouldn't have played into that stereotype.
Yeah, it was very much kind of feeling like what I assume what like doing blackface would be. Like I really felt like I was selling out, you know. Yeah. And it was early in my career. I still had a day job, so I was looking for a way to be able to just be acting and doing comedy. And in all honesty, I did two or three of those parts. And then I told my agents no more. And so I stopped doing those. And it feels great not to do any more terrorist parts.
So tell me about Jimmy Vestwood.
Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero, is a movie that I co-wrote, co-produced, and I star in. I describe it as the Persian Pink Panther meets Borat. It's just a silly slapstick comedy. And it's my attempt at having a hero of Middle Eastern descent in an American movie. And this movie came out in limited release in the spring. And now we have a few more screenings. There's going to be one actually on October 2nd in Newton.
That's Newton. Right. Newton, Mass.
Yeah, October 2nd, Newton, Mass. People can go to jimmyvestwood.com, which is VESTVOOD.com, to see the trailer and then hopefully go see the movie or get it on iTunes. It's also available on iTunes.
All right. Well, that's comedian and actor Maaz Jobrani. He's going to be performing tonight at the Wilbur Theater at 7:30. You can still buy tickets. You can get more information at RadioBoston.org. And you can also see him in the new movie, Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. It'll be playing at the West Newton Cinema on October 2nd. Maaz Jobrani, what a pleasure to have you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Anthony. Have a great day.
Enjoy Boston and have fun tonight.
All right.
And that's it, folks. That's our show for this week and today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.